Abraham, and he'd rescued them from slavery in Egypt, and we left them praising him on the shores of the Red Sea. Now, if we were to meet them 30 years on from there, we would not find that they were praising. In fact, they were just about doing the opposite. They were grumbling. And they were grumbling because they were bored. They were bored for quite a number of reasons. See, 30 years on from when they had just been brought out from Egypt, instead of enjoying Canaan, which they should have been doing, they were still in the desert. And it was boring in the desert, not because they were drilling for oil, but for some other reasons. The first reason was that in the desert they were not going anywhere. See, they couldn't go forward into the promised land, into Canaan, because they had been disobedient. They couldn't go backwards into Egypt because the sea was in the way. So they weren't going anywhere. Now, I didn't say they weren't moving. They were, most certainly were moving. They were moving in evangelical circles. You see? And maybe you do that. Maybe you've been doing it since the day that you were born. You see, where do you get when you move in circles? Right. So they weren't going anywhere. They were moving, but they weren't going anywhere. And they were bored as a result. And I'd like to ask you a fairly personal question just now, and that is this. Where are you going as a Christian? I'm not talking about heaven when you die. Where are you going as a Christian? See, far too many Christians, quite frankly, are not going anywhere. They don't even see the need to go anywhere. You ask a pastor that question sometimes, or some elders in the church, where are you going? They'll say, going. Are we supposed to go somewhere? We thought we'd arrived. We're elders. I'm a pastor. Well, if they've arrived, it really wasn't worth going, was it? And if you're not really going somewhere as a Christian, if you've not got some objectives, and if you're not moving forward with the Lord Jesus Christ in a greater maturity and intimacy with him, you'll be bored, and you deserve to be. Where are we supposed to get to? To the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Did you get there yet? Then maybe you should still be moving. Then they were bored in the desert because they weren't doing anything. I mean, they filled up 24 hours somehow. Everybody does, don't they? Every one of us somehow or other manages to fill up 24 hours every day. Even if 20 of it is just sleeping. You know? We all fill it up somehow. Ride a horse all day until we get calluses where we need them. And all of us managed to fill the time up somehow, and so did they. I mean, probably every day they took the tents down and put them up again. You know, it's really exciting. But they didn't farm the desert because it doesn't farm very well. And they didn't build in the desert because they weren't supposed to stay there. They did collect manna every morning, which probably took them about 20 minutes. And the rest of the day, I don't know what they did. Maybe they built sandcastles. It seems to be a reasonable thing to do when you're in the desert. But they were bored because they weren't really doing anything. Now, look back over the past year, not just the time you've been here, because that might be a little unfair. But what have you been doing as a Christian? You know, what definite end product did your Christian activity have? Well, I'm not asking you, did you fill the time up? I'm sure you did. But what did it achieve? Because if you weren't actually doing something as a Christian, you're probably bored. And you should expect to be. People who don't do anything usually are bored. And one of the weaknesses of many of our church systems is this: it doesn't create either the stimulus or the structure in which people can do anything. other than turn up, stand up at the right time, sing what they're told to sing, sit down and listen when they're supposed to, and come back next week. There's a little bit more to it than that. So they were bored in the desert because they weren't going anywhere, bored in the desert because they weren't doing anything. They're also bored because of the diet, which consisted of manna, which roughly translated means, what is it? Have you ever been served that? Very fortunate if you haven't. What is it? I had it for 2 years in the army, every day. But they had it for 40 years. And they had it boiled, and they had it fried, and they had it roast, and they had it easy over and sunny side up, and grilled, and scrambled. But it still tasted suspiciously like manna. And after 30 years, it was getting just a little bit tedious. Now imagine two teenagers meeting there in the desert, okay, with the great formality with which teenagers always greet each other. Hi! Hi! Where are you from? I'm from Moab. Where are you from? Israel. Israel? Yeah. The people of God? Yeah. Oh, it must be great to be one of God's people. Yes, it is. Wonderful. Hey, I'd like to see your lifestyle. You would. Here, can I come visit you? Can if you like. Where do you live? You see that tent over there? What, that scruffy bit of goatskin on a pole? Yeah, I see that. Well, that's where I live. You live in that? Yeah. What for? Never thought about it, really. Well, it's different, is it? Yeah. So, can I come visit you? Sure. Why don't you come after supper? Oh, that's not very hospitable. Can I come and have supper with you? Can if you like. Do you like manna? Do I like what? Exactly. But what's manna? It's what we're having for supper. How do you know? Oh, I know. No, but seriously, you haven't been home to ask yet. I don't need to go. We never have anything else. Really? Hmm. You live in that tent, and you eat manna all the time. I thought you had a great God. Oh, we do. What's he done for you? Oh, God, he's great. He rescued us from Egypt. Boy, it must have been bad in Egypt. Oh, it was. It was awful. We used to have melons. Terrible it was, terrible. And onions and leeks and garlic and awful, awful. God saved us from all that. Now we have manna. So when was that? 30 years ago. Well, what's he done for your sins? Sins? What do you mean, sins? He gives us manna. Yeah, but apart from that, what do you do all day anyway? Huh? Those are your sandcastles down there. Hey, Ed, do you like them? I'm our tribal champion. Oh, very nice, yeah. I stopped building sandcastles when I was 5. Did you? What do you do? I better not tell you. Yeah, I suppose not. Wouldn't you like to be an Israeli as well? No, thank you. And they didn't have much of a testimony, really, did they? And they were sort of embarrassed and ashamed of themselves, and they were a rotten witness, and they were bored stiff, and everybody else laughed at them. Bit of a familiar picture sometimes, isn't it, with a certain brand of Christianity. And all that kind of Christian can talk about is the day when they were converted and all the things that God saved them from, like blue movies and swear words and beer. And there's nothing positive about it at all. And they didn't have much of a testimony. It wasn't meant to be like that. Just turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8. You see, he wanted to give them Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. So it would be very sticky and they'd need rubber boots to get around. Deuteronomy chapter 8 verse 6. Observe the commands of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and revering him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with streams and pools of water, with springs flowing in the valleys and hills, a land with wheat and barley, vines and fig trees, pomegranates, olive oil and honey, a land where bread will not be scarce and you will lack nothing, a land where the rocks are iron and you can dig copper out of the hills. When you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. So a terrific land that he had in store for them had absolutely everything that they could possibly need. Because back then in the Old Testament, his plan for them had two sides, a negative side and a positive side. The negative side was get them out of Egypt and slavery. The positive side was bring them into Canaan and all its plenty. In the New Testament, that corresponds to get them out of sin by the death of Jesus Christ, providing everything that they need for life right now by the life of Jesus Christ. And just as then, everything that God had for them was in the place called Canaan, so now everything that he has for us, we have in the living person of Jesus Christ. Ephesians 1:3, he has blessed us with every spirit-mediated blessing that exists in heaven in the person of Jesus Christ. But back then they got stuck between phase 1 and phase 2. They got out from Egypt, but it took them 40 years to get into Canaan. And during those 40 years, they were just bored and barren. Pretty useless as far as being any kind of testimony to God, and really sort of hankering over the old life before they were saved. It wasn't meant to be like that, but that's the way it was. Sometimes it happens to Christians now, and their sins are definitely forgiven, but they haven't really entered into life in Jesus Christ. That brings us up to the end of Deuteronomy. They've still not made it into Canaan. But they do cross over at the beginning of the book of Joshua. The book of Joshua is about the conquest of Canaan, which is to be their home. We could put it up here. There it is, there's Canaan. This here's the Mediterranean Sea. Right opposite that little peninsula there is a lake which you will have heard of called Galilee. Flowing into it is a river you'll have heard of called Jordan. Flowing out of it, the same river. Down there, the Dead Sea. Opposite the top, a bit near the river, is Jericho. A little bit further away, Jerusalem. So this is the country, all this land here west of the Jordan that they were to occupy. That's called Canaan. And there are three world powers in that area. Not all powerful at the same time, but they rise and fall at different times. They are called the egg, the ass, and the baby. That, of course, is Egypt. This one, of course, is Assyria. And this one, of course, is Babylon. So at this time, naturally, it's Egypt, which is a powerful nation. The other two are yet to rise to power. But that's their promised land, and the book of Joshua is all about the conquest of that land. They take most of it. One or two places they don't capture, like Jerusalem, didn't capture it in Joshua's time. Following on from Joshua, there's the book of Judges. Judges is what happened after Joshua. When the people were obedient to God, they enjoyed the produce of the land, the milk and the honey, etc., and the good times, materially, lots of blessing. When they were disobedient, then other tribes would come raiding in, conquer them, oppress them, force them to pay very heavy tribute, reduce them almost to slavery. And then when they finally repented and turned to God, then he would raise up someone who would lead them in military conquest, and they would throw out the oppressor. See, whether it was the Philistines with Samson or the Midianites with Gideon, people like that. And then for a while everything would go great, and then they go back into sin. And the phrase, or the line rather, that God used for that is this: every man did what was right in his own eyes, instead of what was right in God's eyes. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, not necessarily what was wrong in his own eyes, but they paid no attention to to God himself. He didn't allow him to rule. Well then, the children of Israel want to have a king, because there's no established leadership. And it's a very haphazard affair, waiting for God to raise someone up. So they say, let's have a king, then we'll know where we are. All the other nations have a king, why don't we have a king? We want to be like all the rest. Of course, they weren't supposed to be like all the rest, they were supposed to be different. They were a unique people, rescued by God, so that they might know him, and so that they might show what he was like. I've forgotten a little bit, but I should have put in back there. And that is the establishment of the old covenant, or the old agreement between God and his people. And it was established on the basis of law. And we won't turn to it, but the relevant chapters are Exodus 19 and 20. And when a king conquered a nation back then, what would usually happen is, having conquered the people, he would say to them, by way of proclamation announced by a herald or something, I am Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of Judah, king of Israel, king of Assyria, king of Phoenicia, king of Philistia, etc. And all the lands that he'd conquered, that's who I am. Now this is what I expect. Because I'm your king now, you will pay me this and this and this, and you will provide so many slaves, and you will provide so many soldiers for my armies, so many oxen and so many sheep for my economy, etc. And he would tell them everything that he expected from them, and also what they'd be allowed to do, whether or not they'd be allowed to worship or whether they'd have to worship the gods of the conquering nation. So God gave them that kind of format on Mount Sinai. And he says, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. In other words, not somebody who has conquered you by power, but somebody who has rescued you by love, redeemed you. Therefore, and it follows the Ten Commandments, and then the moral law, and then the religious law. And all these things are ways in which they could know, first of all, what God is like, and second, they could show what he's like. Is that something essential to the class? Is it? No. Well, it's really not very mature behavior, quite apart from anything else. And I could call it a lot of other things. If you're interested, I'll tell you later. I know you didn't initiate it, but I know who did. Sorry about that. I hate interrupting classes for the sake of individuals like that. Sometimes it's necessary. The laws, every last law they gave was a good law. Now you remember what good means, don't you? It means like God. So, every law that he gave was a good law, and every law he gave is still a good law. Because good doesn't change, because God doesn't change. Okay? So back then, he says, you will not commit adultery. Okay? Now, what's wrong with adultery? It's popular, isn't it? Majority of people in your country and mine do it anyway. You know? It's popular. It's enjoyable, apparently. Never tried it, but I'm prepared to believe it is. If it's popular and it's enjoyable, why isn't it good? Well, it's not good because it's not like God. See, God is faithful. Absolutely faithful. He doesn't mess around at all. And he keeps absolutely every promise he ever makes. Never breaks them. And God is faithful. If he were a man, he would not be an adulterer. So the law says, you will not commit adultery. What's wrong with it? It's not like God, and therefore it's not good. It's never going to be good. God is honorable. If he was a man, he wouldn't be a thief. You know, sometimes very convenient to steal. You know, can help your bank balance no end. But it'll never be right because God isn't a thief. And we're supposed to be like God. So all the laws that God gave were the way that God would behave if God was a man. And by studying the laws, Israel would know what kind of a person God is. And by keeping those laws and acting them out, they would demonstrate what kind of a person he is. And the rest of the world watching Israel would be able to see, lived out in the nation of Israel, an example of the righteousness and justice and love and mercy and holiness of God. So the laws were designed so that they would know what he was like and so that they would show what he was like. And then in addition to the laws, he also gave them religion. Suppose that instead of growing up in Canada or wherever you grew up, that you had been a 7-year-old in Israel back in those days in the desert, where you live in a tent and you've got 4 or 5 animals that you brought out of Egypt, and one day, the old cow gives birth to a beautiful, flawless, little white calf. And there it is, beautiful little creature. And you can hardly believe it when your dad says to you, that calf is your responsibility. You have to look after it. You make sure it gets plenty to drink. Make sure it doesn't get left outside in the hot sun. Make sure it gets tethered so it doesn't wander off and get lost. And that it's brought in at night. It's your responsibility. And you're all pleased about it. And you give the little calf a name and it learns its name. It learns to come when you call it. And grows a little bit stronger, a little bit bigger. Then one day your dad comes home and he's looking very, very solemn. And he tells you to put a rope on the calf. And you say, why, Dad? Where are we going? Church. Church? My calf doesn't go to church. I haven't learned any choruses yet. It doesn't know how to pray. You know? And then you see your dad looks so solemn that you stop objecting and asking questions. And then you go along with him. And you arrive at this huge tent with massive bronze altar outside. And when you arrive there, your dad ties the calf to a horn on the corner of the altar. And a priest comes out and he looks very splendid and very formidable. He's got this gold plate on his head which says, Holiness to the Lord. And he's got gold pouches and big gold plate and precious stones studded all over him. And it's a very frightening looking individual. And he comes forward and your dad places his hand on the calf and he tells the priest how he's stolen something that morning. And he's lied to try and cover up his theft. But he can't live with his conscience. And he's returned whatever it was he'd stolen. And the priest listens to him and he takes a sharp knife and he advances on the calf and he severs the arteries in its neck. And all the blood pumps out of its body and the priest catches the blood in a basin. And your little calf dies right in front of your eyes. And then the priest takes the blood and he sprinkles it 7 times on your father. And he tells him that God has accepted the life of your calf for his life in payment for his sin. And you learn a whole lot. You learn that God sees personal sin and he hates it and he regards it as being serious. You've also learned that he is a God who wants to make a way of forgiveness and he wants people to know that they can be forgiven. And then you've got a question in your mind as you go back. And you say to your dad, why did it have to be my beautiful little calf? It was such a nice little animal, it hadn't hurt anybody, and it was all innocent and beautiful. Why don't we kill the sick old cow? She's going to die anyway. Now, why does it have to be my calf? Of course, the whole thing is looking forward to the coming of Jesus Christ, but you wouldn't have known that as a Jew. But your father would explain how only that which is absolutely perfect is good enough for God. And you learned a whole lot. And through the religion, they would first of all know what God was like, and by keeping those religious rituals and going through them, they would show what he's like. So they had the laws and they had the religion and they also had the land. All they had to do with that was enjoy it. And just by enjoying the land that had everything, they would know and they would show that God is a God who anticipates all our needs, loves to supply them in abundance. Very generous hearted God with enormous resources. So they had all those things, all those advantages to be a unique, a different nation, but they wanted to be like all the others. They wanted to have a king. So they get a king. And the king that they get is called Saul. He's the first king. And he was exactly the kind of king that they would have wanted. We've now progressed into the book of 1 Samuel. Samuel was the last of the judges, and he occupies the first 8 chapters or so. Chapter 9 of Samuel, 1 Samuel, introduces Saul, the king. And the rest of 1 Samuel, from chapter 9 to the end, is all about Saul, the king. And he is big. He's about a foot taller than anybody else in the whole nation. So he's physically impressive. He's also very wealthy. He's from a rich family. He's also a really nice guy. He's about the nicest guy in the whole of the country when we first meet him. He changes a little bit later on when he gets jealous of David, wants to pin him to the wall with a javelin, but that's later on. But earlier on, he's a really nice guy. So he gets Saul, but he's a disaster as a king. Absolute disaster. Be nice to go into that, but there's not time. He is eventually replaced by David. And David is the ideal king. And the book of 2 Samuel is all about David as king. You get some of David in 1 Samuel, but that's while Saul is still on the throne. And David captures Jerusalem. First time it belonged to Israel then. At least it belonged to them, but they never took possession of it. So that's the first time they actually took possession of Jerusalem. And David set up the capital of Israel in Jerusalem. He also won great military victories all around, and he established the kingdom, and he took all the land that was supposed to belong in the promise of God to Israel. It's the only time they ever had it, in David's time and in the time of his son, who is Solomon. And Solomon began his reign by asking for the gift of wisdom. And his reign was characterized by wisdom. He was a man of peace. Didn't fight any battles, Solomon. David had already won them all. There was nobody left to fight at that time. And Solomon was important because he built in Jerusalem a temple. David wanted to build it. He wasn't allowed to. He was allowed to get the designs for it. He was also allowed to collect the stones for it. But he was not allowed to build it. So David built it. And in David and Solomon's time, Israel grew very, very rich. And they look back to that as their golden age. Israel has never been as prosperous as they were in those days. They occupied all the land. Solomon was brilliant in multiplying the wealth, making trade agreements, etc. But although he started off being very wise, and Solomon's reign is 1 Kings chapters 1 to 11, when he got to the end of his life, he ceased to be quite so wise. If you'd turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, we'll pick up the story from there. 1 Kings chapter 11. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Mennonites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 slave wives, concubines, and his wives led him astray. Once heard a Japanese boy talking about that, and he said, Solomon had an awful problem. He had 700 wives and 300 cucumbers. It's enough to give anybody indigestion. And so 1,000 wives. And they were all from other nations, and they all worshipped other gods, and they all had other idols, and they brought them into the country, and they imported them at Solomon's expense. And they worshipped them at Solomon's expense. And other people began to copy them. And it wasn't a very good example. Now, anybody who has had the experience of supporting one wife knows that it's a fairly expensive business. Anybody trying to meet to support 1,000 wives who have royal habits knows that it's an extremely expensive business. Now, how do you support your wives if you're a king? Well, if you're a king, you do it by taxation of the people. So Solomon had to impose heavier and heavier and heavier taxes on his people. And they didn't particularly enjoy paying taxes. I mean, not many people enjoy paying taxes. Fewer people enjoy paying heavy taxes. Fewer people still enjoy paying heavy taxes just so the king can have 1,000 wives. You know, imagine what Congress would say if Ronnie Reagan took it into his head that he was going to have that kind of a domestic lifestyle and he wanted to multiply his domestic budget by 1,000. It probably wouldn't go down very well. So it was definitely unpopular with the people, even more so because these were the forerunners, of course, of the Jews. And while nobody likes paying taxes, the Jews like paying them least of all. So Solomon imposes these taxes and the people resent it. But because Solomon is who he is, and at least started off well, and his father was David, whom they admired greatly, and they owed a great debt to David, they let him away with it. But when Solomon died, then his son was about to reign. And his son was called Rehoboam. Rehoboam. It's a nice name to get stuck with. And so there was him, but the people sent a little deputation to him. And they didn't want to pay all these taxes. So they sent a deputation to Rehoboam in chapter 12. Verse 3, so they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. Rehoboam answered, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. How would you advise me to answer these people, he asked. They replied, if today you'll be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, what is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, lighten the yoke your father put on us? The young men who had grown up with him replied, tell these people who have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions. Well, it wasn't a very nice strategy, but Rehoboam accepted that strategy. And he said to the people, I'm going to be even tougher on you than my father was. So they didn't go for that, and there was a rebellion under Jeroboam. Now it gets a little bit tricky here, so you want to make sure you get this. This is Jeroboam the first, and he is the son of Nebat. Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. And there's a big division. And 10 tribes stayed with Jeroboam. And they went north. And they kept the name of Israel. Sometimes they were known as Ephraim, which was the largest tribe out of those 10. And they set up a new capital city called Samaria, like the fat lady, the woman of Samaria. And then there was, terrible, isn't it? Rehoboam, he stayed in the south with 3 tribes. They were Judah, Benjamin, and the 3rd tribe of Levi, who were, if you remember, the priests. So in fact, 2 territories to 10 territories. And they took the name for themselves of Judah. And of course, they're in the south, and they have Jerusalem as their capital. And in Jerusalem is the temple. Now, once every 3 years, every Jewish male was supposed to go to the temple in Jerusalem to worship. And Jeroboam, up here in the north, he saw that as a threat. See, because he thought, if my people, all the men in my kingdom go 3 times a year to Jerusalem, sooner or later they're going to decide to stay down there. And they're going to form an alliance with Rehoboam, go back under the reign of David's family, and they'll rebel against me and kill me. That's bad news. So we must do something to stop them going down to Jerusalem. So he did. Chapter 12, verse 28. After seeking advice, the king made 2 golden calves. He said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. What a hassle, what a drag. Forget it, you don't have to go down there. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, and the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there." Dan being up here. And they went right up there rather than right down to Jerusalem in order to worship. Now the land is divided. It's divided about there. That is Judah. And that is Israel. Now God, of course, in the first commandment, instructed that there are no images to be made. Yes. Absolutely no images of anything that is in the heaven above, in the earth beneath, or in the waters under the earth. They were not to bow down to them. They were not to serve them. And so Jeroboam was disobedient. He caused the whole nation of Israel to be disobedient. And they all turned aside from worshipping the true God, going down to the true priesthood set up by God, the Levites, in Jerusalem. And they established an independent form of worship, which God never authorized, never approved, and it began with golden calves. Now, it might seem very, very silly to you. How could anybody believe that a calf that's just been made had brought them up out of Egypt 600 years ago? Doesn't seem very likely, but people are gullible sometimes, more ways than one. So, time has gone. We'll pause there. Just let's pray.